Good evening, everyone. I'm happy to see you all. You bring light into this dark afternoon, early evening. It's getting dark so early now here in Paris, I suppose in wherever you are as well, but yesterday I had given this, someone gave me this rakusu, my Dharma brother Frank gave me this rakusu during the week of Joa's transmission. He didn't make this rakusu, he bought it actually. He saw it somewhere, I don't know where. And he said when he saw it, he thought of me, so he bought it. It's a beautiful rakusu. It's actually a Rinzai rakusu. The ones that we all have normally are Soto rakusus. So it's interesting. And I had given it to Geno Roshi so that she could write something on the back, because traditionally that's what happens. Your teacher writes something on the rakusus. And I gave it to her maybe a month ago. But then she was busy, and then she went on holiday to Rome, and then whatever. So yesterday she gave it to me. She gave it back to me. And she wrote on the back of it, love everyone, love everything. And she said, as soon as I gave her this rakusu to write on, she knew exactly what she would write. She said, she thinks of me, she thought of that, then that's what she did. So I've been staying with this since yesterday, this love everyone, love everything. She knows, of course, that, as you know, it's become kind of stereotypical about me, is that I always talk about love and everything is love. So it's not only love everything and everyone, but everything is love and everyone is love. So I was thinking about that. And even what I've just said makes no sense to our thinking dualistic mind. So this is what she wrote on my rakusu. It doesn't make any sense. There are things, of course, we don't love. There are things we don't want. There are things we reject. There are people we don't love. Situations. However, what is written there is also, it's the absolute truth. So the relative truth is there's all this stuff, our discriminations, right? But the absolute truth is there are no discriminations. And the only way to truly understand this, what's written on the rakusu, is from this oneness perspective. So I started thinking about that and how does this work? And I thought of, so when we sit in a zendo, whether it's physically in a zendo with other people, whether it's sitting here on the screen with other people, and we have an organization, say we say rules, but there's a whole set of things to do, ways to walk, ways to bow, when to bow, when not to bow, when to sit, when to stand up, how to walk, which way to walk, don't walk in front of the altar, all of this stuff, right? These rules that we've made. But as I've often said about rules, which I first had the realization of this, formulation, reading the French writer Georges Bataille, who we don't normally think of as being a spiritual writer, and yet he's deeply, deeply spiritual. And he has this book called the L'Expérience Intérieure, the interior experience, in which he talks about rituals and forms. And so rituals and forms, because of their absolute impersonal nature, they offer us all an opportunity, each one of us as very personal individuals, singular individuals. These rules offer us this opportunity to not hang on to our personal opinions, how we want to do things, how we want to walk, how we want to sit, how we don't want to walk, don't want to sit. These are opportunities for us to let go of the personal and experience the impersonal, which then allows us to enter what I think it's Suzuki Roshi calls pure practice or wholehearted practice. So in Zendo, that's what is happening. Whether it's on the screen it's a little more loose, but not really, because we have a different set of rules on the screen. We're not all sitting on cushions that look the same in a specific form around the room, but we bring our same intention and join together with the rules that belong to the impersonal that belongs to the Zoom Zendo. And this allows us to let go of our personal attachments and ideas and positions, which is just another way of expressing what we call oneness. This is the absolute. This is non-duality. This offers us an opportunity to experience the oneness and the non-duality that outside of the Zendo, in our everyday life, we're too much involved in the dualistic world. So we can't study it. We can't practice it in the same way as we can when we sit down in Zazen, sitting, meditation, in a practice context. Of course, we do it for ourselves too. And that's what I always encourage beginners, is I say, create your own little ritual at home. If you do this on your own, always sit in the same place. Try to sit at the same time. Have a little ritual. Maybe it's lighting a candle. Maybe it's lighting incense. Maybe it's putting on a specific lamp. Have a little ritual Have a ritual. Give yourself rules. This is a way, it's a structure that supports you, but at the same time, the reason that it supports you is because it allows you to be free from how you want things to be or not want to be. You don't have to think about what chair you'll sit in. You don't have to think about what time you'll sit. You won't have to think about how long, because part of your rules are, I will sit for this amount of time, not more, not less. In the Zendo, that's it. They tell you it's 40 minutes and it's 40 minutes. They tell you it's a half an hour, it's a half an hour. It's not more, it's not less. And you can count on it. I'm talking about Zen practice. In other traditions, they don't have the same frameworks. But we have a very specific, strict framework, which is a huge support. And you can do the same thing at home. And I recommend it, highly recommend it. Because then we have this opportunity to we use this impersonal, the impersonal rules and regulations and rituals to let go of our personal and experience the impersonal all together. Everyone chants the same thing at the same time together. Everyone starts Oriyoki together and ends Oriyoki together. Everyone stands up from Zazen together and walks together, ends walking together, sits down together. And if the person, if the seat across from you is empty, you still bow. You just do it. You're bowing to that seat because that's the ritual. And it's so liberating to not have to think about it and to not be caught up in our personal stuff. So this is how we can enter into this realm of loving everyone and loving everything. Through this impersonal, absolute oneness aspect of our formal practice, we express whatever we've experienced on our cushions and in the zendo and the impersonal. Everyday life is an opportunity to express that. But it's not the ideal place to train and practice. It's the ideal place to train oneness in duality. However, it's complicated to train oneness in oneness because you're so involved with duality. Whereas in Zendo, we're training oneness in oneness. That's the idea about all wearing the same clothes or all wearing dark clothes, so that we don't have to think about what we're going to wear. We're not trying to set ourselves apart. It's like the story I've told that I read about Suzuki Roshi. When the hippies and the flower children in San Francisco came to him, they had long hair and beards and flowery clothing and beads and flowing dresses and elaborate hairstyles. And they asked him, you know, why do you want us to wear black robes and shave our heads? What's the point of that? These were, of course, the people who became monks, but he even encouraged people who weren't monks to wear the black robes. And they said, he said, well, because when you are all in your stuff with your flowers and beards and long hair and everything, I can't tell you apart. But when you all are wearing the same thing and your heads are shaved, I can see who you truly are. It seems counterintuitive. You would think that they all look the same. But actually, he couldn't see who they truly were under all the stuff, under the, all the fancy clothing and everything. Fancy, it wasn't fancy, but hippie style stuff. We're talking, you know, late 1960s San Francisco, so. So there's a great power in everyone doing the same thing. I also have maybe told the story before, but when we first, before Roshi even bought the house where Donna is, the house belonged to my husband's family, actually. And I don't know, most of you know. And so Alain let let teachers, Dharma teachers come and Dharma groups come and use the attic for workshops and meditation practices. And so Roshi, who at the time was not yet Roshi, was sensei, we did our first sesshin ever there, but she didn't own the house. And after that sesshin, we decided that we would start a sitting group. There were only a few students in Paris at the time. And we decided we would start a sitting group. So we said, okay, Wednesday nights, we will sit there in that attic. For some reason, the first week, Roshi couldn't come. She was traveling or something. So four of us went there, and none of us had much meditation experience. You know, I hadn't even been practicing a year at that point. And Alain had practiced a long time, but not in Zen, as had Patrick, who's someone you know, Patrick. But he didn't know Zen either, and his girlfriend, who didn't know Zen either. So we went there, and we had a bell, and we kind of looked at each other, and we didn't really know what to do. And everyone kind of laughed, and it was really uncomfortable. Who was going to ring the bell, and what, and how were we going to organize and everything? So I just said, I just took matters into my own hands because it was so uncomfortable and awkward. So I just said, okay, I'll do it. I had done a few sessions. So I knew basically, I didn't formally know what the Jikido did, but I knew basically what to do. You know, maybe I didn't ring exactly right, but I did it. And it made it so much better. Not that I was this great person, but that it gave us a structure. It gave us a way to, this isn't exactly part of the structure, but we'll allow it. She stepped on the mute button, so it gave us a structure in which to sit, and it freed us. It took us out of our personal stuff about how should we do, really awkward, embarrassed, who's going to do it, how are we going to do it, it's dumb, you know, whatever. This was a huge teaching for me. It was like, it was so obvious, and yet it really showed me the importance of just having the ritual and doing it. Pure practice, just do it, you know? Which is kind of a mantra you've heard me say, just do it. As Roshi used to say, just do it. So, and that's what this is. And then that allows us in everyday life where things are complicated and complex and so dualistic, it allows us to not get fixated or to more easily welcome things as they are, and to maybe not like everything, but to love it. You know, even situations like I recently, this week, my husband's aunt, whose house I live in, actually, we bought the house from her. This was her house. And she lived in this house and worked in it. We bought it from her. We renovated it. We added on to it. But for me, this is very much Françoise's house. And we learned last Saturday that she had COVID and was hospitalized. And on Monday, we learned that she died. She was 90 years old. She had a weak heart. They couldn't really do any sort of reanimation or anything because she was so weak already. She wasn't really sickly, you know. She was very active, I think, more or less. She had problems with her hips, but she no longer lived in Paris. She moved to the south of France when she sold the house to us. Can we love that? Can we love the death of an aunt? Can we love the death of this woman whose house I feel I live in? But it becomes even more complicated because she got COVID from her son and his wife, and none of them were vaccinated. And they were very adamantly against being vaccinated, which is fine. Everybody can have their opinion, but then think, well, maybe they should have been more careful around her, you know? Maybe they should have taken more precautions because they live in two houses that are on the same property, like right next to each other. I don't know. They were very sick as well. They weren't hospitalized. So Can we love that? You know, can we love that situation? It doesn't mean liking it or agreeing with it, or I guess it means embracing it and not indulging in our, oh, they were so ignorant and stupid and irresponsible and they killed their mother, and not enter into that kind of thing. Because what's the point of that, really? Except to create more duality, you know? So can we meet that situation with love and compassion? And I think that my husband's cousin, his cousin, probably doesn't feel so good about what happened. I'm quite sure of it. You know? It's been an opportunity to really think about Françoise, who I don't think much about. Of course, I think of her occasionally because this is her house, but thinking about, you know, how much joy she brought. The people who lived with me in the house next door when I lived there, Roshi and Frank and Michelle and the other people who lived there with me all knew Françoise too. And she will be, they do a service on Friday, and she will be in their service on Friday, tomorrow. And how, you know, how much vitality she had, and she made her living making, you know, like in museums or exhibits or things, they have little, what we call maquettes in French, like a miniature village or a chateau that is, you know, if you're visiting the chateau or the castle and it's in ruins, they will have a little small model of what it looked like when it was whole, scale model. So she made these scale models out of wood and cardboard for museums and things. And this room I'm sitting in, the room across the hall from me, this was her atelier. And it was always full of these, my kids used to love to come in here because it was full of these little figures and little trees that she made. And look at these little model villages or buildings or things. And so, you know, I was thinking about that. And when Roshi gave me this rakusu, we both were talking about Françoise. We mentioned Françoise after that. And she said, yeah, love everything. That too, you know, the situation, someone who's died. And our practice of sitting on our cushion and following the rules, as it were, helps us to cultivate this one mind, this no mind, sometimes we say, this mind of no preferences. The perfect way is not difficult, it just dislikes picking and choosing. So this mind that we cultivate through the rules, that this wholehearted practice, pure practice, is what allows us then to get up and go into everyday life and express that in this world of dualities, what we call the worldly world, you know, or the dust, the dusty world. It's a way of Dogen, you know, in his instructions to monks or to cooks, or his instructions basically, you know, he has a thing about treat everything in the right way. Not right as opposed to wrong, but in the appropriate way. So treat everyone and everything in the right way. That is to love everyone and love everything. So you are probably sitting here thinking, well, how do we know it's the right way? How do we know it's the appropriate way? Well, that's what your practice is about. Your sitting practice is about cultivating this mind that gives you access to the impersonal aspect of yourself, because it's that impersonal aspect that we all share that knows how to treat everything appropriately, has no doubt about it, but we're not usually in contact with that. This is what we all share. We all share this one impersonal I. And when we realize that, that changes everything. Distant from that, you know, our everyday life in the dualistic world. And with science and philosophy and psychology, which have more or less in our modern world replaced religion, or, you know, I think it's Suzuki Roshi who said that after the Renaissance, the Western world lost their way. They forgot about religion. Not religion in like the Vatican, but religion in like what we're talking about, of connecting with this inner, you know, the interior experience, Bhattai, or the impersonal aspect. And I think he said after the Renaissance, because that's when we started, our culture started turning towards la lumière, you know. It was too dark. The medieval, it was too dark. And so the Renaissance became light and turned to reason and science and philosophy. And now it's as if we've gone, I think Suzuki said, you know, before it was too dark and now it's too light. And so all we're doing is looking, and we think that science and philosophy and psychology have all the answers. And even science and philosophy and psychology are becoming mixed in with, we know, cognitive science and Buddhism are, you know, crossing over. And to some extent, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's important that each of them also have their place. So, how do we find this middle light, you know, the right amount of light and the right amount of dark? That's what we do. We sit on our cushion. And we think it's in Orioki where we say promote pure practice, right? I think it's at the end of one of the Orioki chants, I forget, it's like, you know, we eat to do this, and to promote pure practice, I think, something like that. I forget how we say it in French. Et pour quelque chose, une pratique pure. Something like that. So we don't even think about it. So what is pure practice? Well, for me, what I'm talking about tonight is pure practice. It's not about obeying or disobeying the rules or the regulations or the rituals. It's about just doing them so that we can free ourselves from our discriminating attachment to personal mind and gaining access to this experience of the impersonal, which then opens the gates to love everything, love everyone. So, Anyone want to say anything? Anyone questions or?
Roshi, I have one question. Could you clarify what you mean by relative and absolute truth? If I can explain why I'm asking that question, but it's really meaningless.
Did I actually say that, relative and absolute truth?
Yes, just you did. You talked about the truth. Yeah.
I mean, because I don't usually use the terms, but I mean, I use relative and absolute, but truth. I think what I mean is more like there's the relative, the workings of the relative world of duality, as when I say relative truth, that's what I said, that's what I meant. So, you know, where we have a cat and a dog and a man and a woman and old people and young people and vaccinated people and unvaccinated people and sick people and well people and big houses and little houses and enlightenment and delusion, sitting, not sitting. You know. Those are all relative. You know, the relative truth is there's a cat and there's a dog. You know, there's no question about it. There was a cat on my screen. There was a dog on Carla's screen. And my screen is not her screen, and you know, it's her space is her space, and mine is mine, and whatever. There's Rinzai Rakusus and Soto Rakusus, and all this. That's the relative truth, let's say, or the workings of the relative world. And then I'd say the absolute truth is to stay with that term, which I don't really like the notion of absolute and relative truth, but it's true as well. I mean, I'm not denying it. Has more to do with the nature of mind and the world of oneness, where we could say the relative truth is personal and the absolute truth is impersonal, something like that. This oneness where all is one, there are no differences. There are no judgments, there are no discriminations. There is not even any love, there is not even any enlightenment or delusion. We even have this koan, delusion is enlightenment, or the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That's, you know, those are absolute truths in the sense of in truth as opposed to not true, but those are experiences of the absolute world, of the absolute nature, the workings of the absolute, say, instead of the workings of the relative. So truth is not really a good word in that sense, because we associate it so much with right and wrong, true and false. And it's more experiential than what I'm talking about is experiential rather than some fact. It's not factual in that sense, it's experiential. Does that answer the question, more or less? I mean, I explained what I meant in any case, yeah.
Yes, thank you. I can say now why I'm asking that question, because it just happens that just before this afternoon, I had a study group with a bunch of people that I study on secular Dharma. And there was the theme of the day was actually about the truth, the Four Noble Truth, and the relative and absolute truth. And I actually said that in the group that in my practice, we rarely encounter these things, these notions of truth, and I'm not comfortable with that. And yeah, we don't actually talk about it. And then it just happened that you actually mentioned that tonight, like 2 hours after me saying that, you know, we rarely use that. And yet I was also saying that when I read Dogen and we talk about things as they are, and yes, there are some expressions like relative truth and absolute truth. I feel a little bit uncomfortable because I feel that there might be two understandings, and I think you're pointing to one of the things that that's my experience, and one is, I mean, what does that mean when we say reality as it is, or things, yeah, or the absolute and all that, all these language? And for me, the what I feel is like something that is entangled or not entangled with ourselves, which is very different from another conception that would be like a metaphysical statement about the world. The world is like this, and this is what I think you are trying to avoid also. And so the experience of the absolute the relative truth or the absolute is not a statement about the world is such and such. And then I realized today that actually when I was thinking, where do we have these types of statement that we actually encounter? And I was thinking the four vows that we say, you know, sentient beings are numberless. Could that be kind of a metaphysical statement? But I thought, this is not really, no, it's not even that. That's not really a metaphysical statement about the world. It's not, it's more like an experiential relation that we have with the world. So, I mean, I felt for me, it felt like these notions of truth as, not in terms of truthfulness in the sense of authenticity, but in terms of, yeah, if we talk about the truth, is more about something entangled, not entangled with myself, something authentic, instead of a statement that I'm making about the way the world is, something like that. Is that clear?
I think so. Yeah. I think this kind of leads us to the demonstration of how because language belongs to the relative world, workings of a relative world, it will always be approximate when it's trying to express the absolute. And even these terms, relative and absolute, are approximate. Or even oneness and two-ness, or oneness and difference, or oneness and duality. Those are just approximations, because language will be approximate. It cannot. So we say true words or truth or something. That those are approximations, or pure practice, even pure. You know, what do we mean by pure? It's not as pure in the sense that it's something else is impure. Language is a challenge, and you know, I'm a writer telling you this. It's a challenge. This is why poetry for me is the true expression with words, because it doesn't. Language is used in a way that is not bound by logic and making sense. You know, there's this Talking Heads song, "Stop Making Sense." Maybe all of you are too young to know Talking Heads, but stop making sense. You know, that's a really profound thing. Stop making sense. And poetry does that, allows us that. Art in general allows us that. Of course, there is art that, I guess we could get into a discussion of what is truly art, but Freddie's laughing because he sees me getting into these traps with everything I'm saying. So I won't go there about what is art. Poetry, yeah. Yes, Freddie?
I'm just laughing because there's no words that can describe reality. We can try to describe chocolate or anything. No words can really describe reality. And it's a failure to discuss. That's why we have poets, we have, there's no words that can describe reality. It's always an experience. And just I have a question, please. We have a soto hakusu, mm-hmm. and there's a...
Yeah.
What is your design behind?
Yeah, it doesn't have that. Unfortunately, there's a story with this. It has a triangle, which you can't really see because it's not really done very well. It was originally done well, but the rakusu was too long for me. So Helen, my Dharma sister, offered to repair it. She's a good seamstress, and she offered to repair it and make it shorter. But in order to make it shorter, she had to take off this part, right? You have to take this off and cut the straps or do whatever she had to do. And when she was short for time and she put it back together, she didn't have time to do the triangle properly. So since September, I am supposed to have done the triangle properly, and I haven't done it yet, but it's a triangle.
Because I know that in Soto, there is one design. In Rinzai, there is another design. So I just wanted to...
And the design, too, is different. It has these squares here in the corners, which we don't have. And the back, there is no border on the back, see? It just goes to the edge, all the way to the edge.
Sorry, because I'm talking about this stuff because we've been doing that. So I was just, sorry.
It's also bigger. It's bigger. The rectangle is bigger. So, yeah. But, you know, Freddie, it's true, you know, there's nothing... And so, because Freddie and I, we both like basketball, and sometimes we talk about sports. I used to play basketball, and so did he. Maybe he still does, but I don't. And so, you know, like, you can't, nothing can describe, or nothing, no words can truly do Michael Jordan. I just picked Michael Jordan because he's like this amazing basketball player that maybe everyone has heard of. I don't know. Or, you know, Stephen Curry doing a three-pointer, beautiful three-pointer. The one I often give is Zinedine Zidane doing this amazing goal in the Champions League final. Nothing, no words, there's no words. It's experiential, and their action is in line with what we're talking about. They are one with what they're doing. Pure practice in that moment. And that's the same way art doesn't have words. You know, critics like to do it, and they, you know, people write stuff about poems and about movies and about paintings and stuff, but that's not at all what the painting and the movie and the poem are about, you know, not at all. Debbie?
Well, thank you very much for the first part, because when you were talking about the death of Varane's aunt and everything, I think that was my question of a couple of weeks back. Not how do you see things as they are, but how do you stand things as they are, love things as they are, accept things as they are, when very often they are not very lovable.
Yeah, so we could say, you know, outside of the Zendo, just to stick with this example, it's not lovable. But inside the Zendo, when I'm just using this as a metaphor, inside and outside the Zendo, but from the inside the Zendo being from the interior experience, the oneness and non-duality, and outside the Zendo being the duality. Now, of course, you know, I famously also tell you, you know, don't leave the Zendo. The Zendo's out there too. But that's just a way of saying, bring this experience of the impersonal and oneness into your everyday life of duality.
How?
Yeah. Well, the more you sit, it's like that image I give of walking through a field at dawn, of tall grass at dawn. You don't realize it, but your pants are getting wet. Your shoes are getting wet. The dew on the grass at dawn is soaking into you. And it's the same thing with your Dharma practice. You sit and you sit and you sit and you practice and you work on your koans and you sit and you sit and you do this stuff even if you don't, you know. You just do it, you ring the bell and you eat the oryoki. And I know lots of people don't like oryoki, lots of people love it. It doesn't matter if you like it or you don't like it, you just do it. And that's the point of just doing it. So the more that you become immersed in the impersonal, the more that then in the everyday world of duality, it becomes more present as well. It's not really a recipe, but it's what we do. You know, it's our practice. It's the best way I know in my experience. And all I can tell you is my experience, right? So, Claudia?
I don't know if it's working, my son. Yeah, is it, do you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Hello. I'm laughing because I think there is something really tough for me is to be dressed in black during session. It's just impossible for me, but it's great because you said just do it. So, but it's funny because I feel like I would disappear. It's really strong because I hate black. I hate the color black since I'm very small and since I'm little and I cannot wear black. It's really like, so for me, it's like a huge, I mean, that's something just to wear, to be all in black, but okay, just do it.
Well, and that's very interesting because it's true, you will disappear. I mean, the I who's attached to not wearing black then has to let go, you know? I know that I chose to, when I started my own Sangha, I didn't insist on that point. When I started out, I was wearing a robe. And I was the only one wearing a robe, and it became this absurd thing where we wore the robes so that we were all alike. And I was dressed special and different and putting myself in this position of being different than everybody else. So I forget this and I took off the robe. But I never insisted on wear dark clothing because I wanted us to come to that because we wanted to, not because it was a rule or because I imposed it. But I was starting in a context where we invented everything as we went along. So we added the rules little by little. Lisa's writing, it's liberating. What's liberating, Lisa?
Wearing black? No, yeah, but it is hard to get to it. Start wearing black. And once you do, it's just doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. Myself, when I started, I didn't have trouble wearing black, but it did take me a while to make the step to wearing a robe. That was a hard one. For very similar reasons. It was like, oh, letting go of, I don't know what exactly, but you know. And then when I did it, it was great. It was like, I didn't have to think about it anymore. It's just what I wore. Freddie, you have your hand up, yeah?
Even sitting for 2 hours, I remember I just wanted to go. It was too much. I just wanted to flee, and it was liberating to surrender from, I just wanted to go. I don't know. I wanted to flee. I had to learn something from it. So it's good to be intimate to what you are and what you fear, what you, I don't know, it was my journey.
Yeah, I think you can recognize that too, everyone.
I personally really like wearing robe or samui or whatever. I feel there's so many levels to it. One is that it's true that it gives a sense of unity and impersonal, and we all in there together. And there's another element that I find that it's about, there's something I personally find kind of as a part of the container, like ennobling, like we. It's like washing up before going to work, something like that. It's something that help us to, as wearing the rakusu, I find that gives a structure that helps, that's we know that it kind of looks bad to fall asleep while you have your rakusu on. It's like it gives a sense of I don't know, it's container. I don't know how to express that, that I appreciate very much. If you're wearing a robe or if you're wearing a rakusu, maybe I know that I'm not going to be as sloppy, something like that. I take care of it. This whole thing with a kesa, it's like you can't sit on it, you have to. And when you know how much work it requires to actually do it, you don't want to sit on it. You don't want to stain it. You don't want to eat jam and having the jam fall on it. So it's like suddenly you have to be fully attentive and aware of what you're doing. So I really appreciate that. That's part of it. Yeah.
I think someone else had their hand up before Joao talked. Was it Joao? No? No. Okay. Maybe a mistake. Marlene.
You have to unmute, Marlene.
Now?
Yep.
Thank you. I have this silly question because I realize it's the first time I am sitting in winter and in this Zendo Zoom. I don't know, it's about rakusu also. Each time now, it's my third time with you, I sit with you. I put the rakusu and it was like what Joa was saying. It's so clean, it's not sloppy. I put the rakusu, but then I have so much, it's really cold in here. I don't know, is it acceptable to put something above the rakusu?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's what I don't know if it is, no, I noticed nobody had this thing.
Lisa is, I think. Lisa is, yeah.
Yes, okay. So it's a silly question. Thank you.
Well, I put something on, but I never thought about it being, if I could or not, it was cold.
Yes, I surely would put it because it's cold, but is it above, is it, what stays above? Or, well, it could have been something, how to do it. Okay.
Well, I don't think, there may be if we were in a monastery in Japan, but there isn't for me. And everyone's seen me, I wear things, you know, and sometimes on top, sometimes I put the rocks on top, you know, but it's okay. Good question though, Marlon. There's no silly questions.
Thank you.
So,
est-ce que je peux parler français? C'est bien pour tout le monde?
Maybe Carla, I don't know.
Carla, tu comprends français?
No problem. You can speak. Yes, if you speak slowly, I will understand.
Okay. Yes. Ah, et Claudia.
Oh oui, oui, oui.
Oui, peut-être c'est approprié de raconter en ce moment. J'ai envoyé une petite image à Rocher hier, et j'ai dit que je voulais partager avec entre nous, et peut-être ça vient comme ça à cause des rakuzu. Parce que cette image, c'est quelque chose que j'ai dessiné dans mon cahier quand j'étais après le retrait d'été. Et ça, c'est une image que j'ai. Après, on était ici le matin, moi, Joan et Depp, et on était à parler de s'exprimer. C'était pas une chose de langage, c'était pas l'anglais ou le français ou le portugais. C'était que j'ai dit que pour moi c'était plus une chose de savoir utiliser les mots qui vont plus direct et qui pour moi c'était difficile. L'expression, c'était pas seulement à cause de la langage. Et on était à parler, et tout d'un coup, Debbie, elle a dit, avec cette langage si propre d'elle, parce que j'ai dit que je comprenais bien Amy, sa langage, et Debbie, elle, tout d'un coup, a dit: oh, oh oui, cette femme, elle fait des colliers avec des mots. Et ça a resté pour moi comme ça, des colliers avec des mots, de faire des colliers avec des mots pour les Dharma Talk. Et c'est une image qui s'est toujours avec moi. Et j'étais en ce moment à faire mon rakuzu aussi, et c'était les colliers, comme dans les Dharma Talk, qu'on garde pour nous des petites phrases qui sont des colliers. Et c'est ça que Amy nous donne beaucoup. Mais aussi les autres, dans l'été, le session d'été, c'était toujours très présent pour moi. On a écouté Geno Roche parler, quand on a écouté Frank parler, c'était pour moi, depuis cette phrase de Deb, ce sont toujours des colliers pour moi. Et c'était ça, c'était un dessin que j'ai fait, c'est seulement comme ça pour ma mémoire. C'est...
Yeah.
C'est seulement pour partager parce que c'était une... Je pense que c'est une bonne image.
Non, merci.
Et merci de pouvoir parler en français. C'était bien, Carla? Merci.
Thank you, Sil, because yesterday when she sent me the message, she sent me the drawing and she said, there's a story that goes with it, but I didn't get the story. And so I wrote back and I said, oh, now I would really like to know what the story is. So now I know. Thank you. Okay, we are out of time, or we are full time, let's say. And so we'll say the vows and finish.